From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 year ago when a new study looked at the potential positives and negatives of using a restorative justice approach in schools. You might have heard the term restorative justice or restorative practice. The short version that I'm sure I'll be corrected on soon is that it's essentially the opposite of zero tolerance. It's an approach rooted in personal responsibility and accountability, bringing people face to face with the goal of improving behavior without suspensions or expulsions when possible. But there haven't been many studies to suggest whether the practices work. There's a great deal of evidence in the form of suspension rates, graduation rates, anecdotes, but a year ago we saw a formal study that analyzed the impact. And what the study found was that both students and adults reported all kinds of benefits. Benefits they don't see in a zero-tolerance system. We're going to talk about that later this hour. But first, our attention turns to an event this coming Saturday in Rochester. It's called Restoring Rochester, and it aims to bring restorative practices and ideas to our entire community. Our guests will explain. Let me welcome them now. Kit Miller is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, which is helping sponsor that event on Saturday. Kit, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And Ruth Turner is the executive director of Student Support Services for the Rochester City School District. Ruth, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you again.
Well, Kit, I'll start with you. You got this conference on Saturday, and from what I was seeing online, I think you still have some space open. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, right. We're hoping to have the Holiday Inn overflowing.
There you go. $15 a person to sign up for the conference that runs 8:30 to 2 p.m. at the Holiday Inn downtown on Saturday. And you've got some broad themes here, but let's talk about why you wanted to do this conference now. I'll start with you, Kit. Tell me about that. You want to turn to Ruth first for that, or?
I think we can bounce back and forth.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, this is part of a multi-year effort. Year in and year out, we are trying to move the needle on how children and adults relate to each other when things get challenging. And so we were on a year ago with Fania Davis, Angela Davis's sister. You were kind enough to have us on then. We were on 6 months ago, and Dominic Barter from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, was here. So this is the latest, part of the commitment of really helping to move the needle in this community about conflict, especially how it affects our young people.
Okay, Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, I want to just add to that. We're really excited. We have two great speakers that are coming to address us. And I also want to just emphasize that this is in part funded by My Brother's Keeper Initiative. So we're very excited about that. And as Kit said, we're just really trying to move our entire community along this idea of restoring and healing and growing together and reconnecting one to another.
All right. First, I want to ask Kit to correct my definition on restorative justices and practices. And then I want Ruth to, and by the way, that volume on there, the knob is your headphone volume in case it's on or off there. There you go. Okay. Sorry about that, Ruth. How many times have you been in the studio? And I'm finally telling you how it works here, see?
But it's always worked before.
Very good. And then after kind of we get the definition, Ruth, I think it will be valuable for our listeners to understand in Rochester, especially in the schools, what has changed in terms of how often the practice is used, what we're starting to see. But let's start with the definition. Kit, how do you define restorative practices, restorative justice?
When I'm asked to do it, I speak about restorative practices as a community-based response to harm and trauma. Instead of deciding who is the offender and who is the victim, we discover who's the author of the act, who's the receiver of the act. We ask different questions. We ask what happened, who was affected, what were you thinking at the time, and how can we make it right? So the process is a teaching process. It helps people to develop morality, empathy skills, separating their stimulus from response patterns. It's a very old practice. The Haudenosaunee people on whose land we all live and are talking to each other right now, this is from them. I remember doing a conference years ago at the RIT Women's Council on this very topic, and a woman who's a senior leader at RIT, who's also a clan mother of the Seneca Nation, approached me and she said, this is our process. So it's a very old process that we're just rediscovering as one that makes enormous human sense.
Okay. And Ruth, when it comes to Rochester City Schools, the practice has expanded, yes?
Yes, we have about 26 schools that are actively participating in what we call our professional learning communities around restorative practice and really examining or re-examining how we do business, how we interact with one another. So we're really excited. We get together Once a month, spend a couple of hours learning some skills, planning our work, and really implementing some strategies and changes in terms of how we relate to students. So I want to clarify, because oftentimes, you know, people will say, or if I'm practicing restorative practice, then that means that I'm no longer able to suspend. I really want to separate the two. The idea and the philosophy behind it is that the more we're connected, the more we really learn and understand each other's story, the less likely we're to do harm. And eventually, the less likely there's a reason to suspend. So oftentimes, you know, people are saying, oh, you know, you're trying to take away our power to suspend or hold children or students accountable. Not at all. We do the 80-20 rule. I've said it before. 80% of the time, if we focus on building community, and 20% addressing wrongdoing in the initial couple of years of implementing restorative practice, the less likely there will be a need to suspend students or to have those infractions against each other.
Okay, but go ahead.
I just want to say, I was in a high school on Friday and speaking to the person there that coordinates the restorative work, and we were doing an assessment of the year. And she celebrated their long-term suspensions are down 80%. So, and she credited it to the effort that the building has made the last couple of years in restorative practices. So we don't have official numbers yet out of the district, but the anecdotal evidence, both with the numbers as well as the stories that are coming out, by and large, are that this is really beginning to make big changes in people's lives, teachers too, not just children.
All right, so you're dragging me ahead in my notes, by the way, here, Kip, because I was going to wait to get to this, but I hate to drag you.
Sorry.
For someone in nonviolence, too, it's weird to be dragged.
I know.
Kip.
I'm very sorry.
But let me address.
Maybe we could have a restorative process about it later.
Yes. She mentioned Dominic Barter, who was in about 6 months ago now. Is that right?
In early January.
Remarkable man, who has done work in as now Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and talked about the work that he has done and now taking some of his concepts around the world. And this Psychology Today article that I cited off the top actually looked at, it was a formal study of restorative circles pioneered by Dominic Barter in a school setting. Now, one of the things that the Psychology Today article was looking at was the idea that, you know, if you just look at suspension rates, which you just referenced, well, that might be at least in the short run a little misleading, because the idea is once you implement restorative practices, you suspend less anyway. Is that fair, Kit?
I think it can. I mean, I think it would be fair because there's just not such a need. And also things get caught earlier and people's ability to navigate conflict goes up as a collective. So all sorts of reasons why there'd be less of a need to long-term a kid, which is the most extreme consequence short of expulsion.
Okay. So, but I think what the article was noting was if you just look at suspension rates, let's say you take a zero tolerance approach, which is going to be a lot of suspension, more expulsion, and you take a restorative practice approach, which is going to be less, right off the bat, within weeks, within days, within months, you're going to see fewer suspensions. It's just a different approach. The question is, are behaviors getting better? Are infractions changing? Yeah, Ruth.
Yeah, I think it's a school climate work. So suspension tells a small bit of the story.
Okay, yep.
And I know we're very data-driven. We want to look at suspension. But it's also the school climate, the environment. So you see also increase in attendance because students feel they're welcomed in that environment and want to be a part of that environment. You see where decision-making and power is shared, not just amongst the grown-ups, but also with the students. Students' voices elevated. So because of that, you will see students more engaged and less likely to be suspended because they feel like they are part of the educational process. So it's really power with and not power over. So there is the practice of no longer having zero tolerance and being more tolerant, I guess, of behavior. That's one aspect. What we want to do is a mind change shift, thinking in our mindset to say that, okay, let's share this power that we have as educators in the school, as authority figures with our students, because we believe in their ability to problem solve. We believe in their ability to have personal accountability. And because we empowered the students to with that level of responsibility, they rise to the occasion, and there's oftentimes a decrease in that negative behavior. And then the school climate environment as a whole is a better place.
So let's hear the voices of some students. This study, the nice thing is it included the voices of students at this urban high school in Virginia who've gone through these kind of circles, these practices. And Kit, before we dive in on this, remind our listeners what a restorative circle is. We've been talking about some terms here, but that's worth revisiting just briefly. Go ahead.
A restorative circle is sort of the formal usage of restorative practices in terms of a structure. So it's actually, instead of an approach that's restorative, which is kind of the philosophical piece that Ruth was just naming, a restorative circle is sitting down in a formal way with the people that were involved in the harm, a facilitator, and there's a set of questions, and it's a process that has gone through, and it's used in schools, it's used in courts here, it's used in faith communities, it's being widely more and more used.
Can I just add there's also an important element to that when you sit in circle, regardless of your title, regardless of your age, we're all equal in a circle. I don't come in a circle as executive director or teacher. We're all equal. Everybody's voice has the same level of importance. And that's the difference between merely just sitting in a
circle. There's no head of a circle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And so here is...
Interesting and threatening.
And threatening?
For some. I mean, if you're only trust that you matter because of your role or your rank... And suddenly you're asked to go into a space where you're on the same human level with everybody else. For some, that's a big pill to swallow. So I just want to acknowledge it's not the easiest thing. You can just sit here and be kind of innocent and not even say, we just sit down and we're all equal. That's hard for some of us and for most of us. But for some, it's harder than others, especially when you don't trust that you're going to matter. Without your rank, without your role.
That's actually a very good, if I could just take a second to just share a story that just triggered my memory. We were doing some work with a particular high school in the city, and the school leader was like, I'm really interested to hear what our students think about our school and what needs to happen. I'm really interested in having a circle and sitting down with them. And we really prepared her to say, okay, people can say anything. They speak from the heart in the circle, and you got to make sure you're prepared for that, not to take it personal. And it was really just great to see students give their principal feedback and say, hey, this is what's working in our school, as we circled up. This is what's not working. These are some changes we need to make. And then being able to give that feedback to the principal, knowing that they're being heard. And it was really sobering for her to look back and say, wow, I've never thought about capturing our students' voice in this kind of a way and taking that back to the teacher and the school system and saying, okay, these are some changes we need to make because this is how our students feel, this is their perception, and this is what they need.
All right, so from the article here, outcomes of a restorative circle program in a high school setting. They went down to an urban high school in Virginia where more than 90% of the students are African American, more than 75% are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And that's a school that used restorative circles pioneered by Dominic Barter and Associates in Brazil. And they found 6 different positive benefits beyond a reduction in suspension, which they found, beyond sort of improved other metrics, graduation rates, those kind of things, attendance. They found that adults and students were pointing out the following. Number one, ownership of the process. Students talked about using the circle process to work through their conflicts because it was, at least some of the time, better than fighting. Students also talked about using the circle process even without adult involvement.
Yep.
They started to use it on their own.
We hear about that here.
And let me quote a 12th grade female. Quote, me and my friend were playing around in class and we actually solved the conflict using a circle. It was fun, but it was serious too, and we decided to do it all by ourselves. Because my friend that used to be in the facilitator circle training... Well, me and her, we were playing at first, but my other friend, the girl I'll call my sister, they were arguing about something, so my friend and I said, let's have a circle. And then we were playing. We played it through, and it actually solved the problem. And now they talk, we all talk, we actually did a circle all by ourselves. 12th grade student, both of you are nodding, saying that's happening in Rochester.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes?
Oh, yeah.
We're training this is our second year of implementation, and now we're training students to facilitate circles on their own with each other, really providing them the empowerment that they need to be able to problem solve, that we know that they're able to do so.
And some kids are just doing it because they've been in enough circles themselves. They just know what to do. I mean, it's not like rocket science. Not, no offense to any rocket scientists out there.
Well, I actually have I'm thinking of all these stories because it's such a wonderful privilege to be in the schools and really teach people this different way of thinking. And we had an incident in which there was a particular school and they were all having circle time at the same time. So there was a handful of students who the teacher felt like they were being disrespectful of the circle. So they were excluded and they were out in the hallway. And it was really interesting to see because when they sent me pictures, I said, what is this? These are the students that were not able to be in circles with their class but decided to circle up on their own in the hallway. And it was really great to see them to be able to have a meaningful circle completely run by students for students.
Yeah.
You're giving them the tools. And then they don't even have to be told to use it. They know how to use
it. Yeah. Can I share a little bit of research that was done here?
Yeah.
Because we don't have to lean on Virginia.
Yeah.
There was research that was done last year at Monroe with Professor Dina Swanson in Counseling and Human Development at the U of R. This is a project we've been working on. So it was a multimodal study. Research on school climate focused on the role of restorative, I'm reading from the report, mm-hmm. focused on the role of restorative practices impacting student experiences and perceptions. Significant and positive correlations were found between restorative practices and students' increased engagement in school, students' ability to navigate adverse school events like flunking or fights or teacher challenges, student reports of supports that successfully help them navigate issues around bullying, which I know is a huge concern for so many schools, students' ability to navigate adverse life effects, late life events, changing residence, the death of a family or friend, incarceration of a family member, students' report of support that affirms their sense of ethnic identity, and students' report, last one, of being effectively supported by teachers and staff, even when behavior problems are encountered. So this is our own homegrown data. We're going to be doing year two of this study at Monroe this year. So there's an increasing body of evidence that says it's silly to not be doing this.
Any negatives, Kit? Do you hear from any teachers who say, I feel like it takes away my ability to be as firm as I want to be?
I could answer that. So initially, some will feel that way, and we say just come and experience the circle. Come to the training. 9 out of 10 times, they leave out saying, wow, this is great, because they've experienced it for themselves. So now they can take it back to their students. So initially, there's a lot of myths, misunderstanding, but once people really understand what restorative practice is, how beneficial it is, not only for our students, but also for us as educators, as teachers, as administrators, then there's a change of thinking around that.
Okay. I think one of the things that's hard is the perception of how much time it's taken. And that's true. It's kind of like it looks like it's time intensive to deal with a conflict in depth instead of putting a Band-Aid on it. But if you didn't deal with this thing and it just came back again and again and again, and the resources that are dealt and the consequences of something not being dealt with, because it's easiest to deal with conflicts when they're small, when they're babies, before they grow armpit hair. Like those are the one you want to catch those conflicts early. So I think if we can use restorative to do that, we're going to, you know, the yield will be and is like safer school spaces and places where people feel like they matter.
Okay. Well, here's number two from Virginia on the good, the benefits that they found. Interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline.
Yep.
Both students and adults spoke about the shift to less punitive methods of dealing with student conflict, and students discussed that a positive outcome of the Restorative Circle program was that they were not getting suspended or locked up as often, and they were on a much better path in life. Here is the quote from an 11th grade female. Quote, I noticed that some fights, some arguments, some got talked out more instead of just suspension, instead of just suspending somebody from school where they got away from their education for like 5 days or more and they didn't learn anything for that time. Instead of doing the suspensions, they could do a circle, and they do the circles, and they sign the paper, and then they go to class, and they become friends again, or they leave each other alone, end quote. Big difference in terms of, I think what this 11th grade student is saying, Ruth, is that, you know, it's one thing to think, well, you're suspended. You're out of school for 5 days. But they're learning nothing. They're getting behind. Maybe all of a sudden you fail a quiz or a test. Maybe all of a sudden you start thinking about what life is like when you're not in school. Maybe skip school more. All of the things that happen. This student is saying just a restorative circle keeps students in. They handle conflict better. They stay in school. It's a better course. You see that here?
Absolutely. And it's interesting because a lot of school leaders are now beginning to tell students, okay, this incident occurred, you have two options. You know, there's the suspension route, which they're entitled to suspend if there's if a school norm has been broken, or you can engage in a restorative process. And you'd be very surprised. People think, you know, restorative practice is soft. It's actually not. It is the highest level of accountability when you must sit and circle up with people.
You're face-to-face with people.
Yes, and be held accountable and then see the harm that is done for other people. So we will encourage students to go through that process, and oftentimes it helps resolve the conflict. Not every time, but most of the time it often resolves the conflict. But what I want to emphasize, and I know we're very much driven to being reactive, is the proactive work. So as I said, we want to spend majority of our time building communities so that we're spending less of our time spinning, you know, our heads around student discipline. So I want to really emphasize that we're really working to be proactive and engage in proactive community building circles. Majority of our time and effort around this implementation is centered around that, because we are so crisis driven. You know what I mean? Something's done, we want to hold somebody accountable, we want to deal with it. But we really believe that you first must make an investment in the emotional bank account of students before you can begin to make a withdrawal. So we want to build those connections. We want to build trusting relationships. And in doing that, we want to be very proactive and deliberate on how we're rolling this out. So I think that's very important to underscore there.
You know, one thing I wonder about, too, as you speak, Ruth and Evan, is I hear a lot, because of the work I'm privileged to do with area colleges, I hear a lot of student life people in colleges, and I'm imagining this is probably true in the K-12 element or environments, as the effects of technology in terms of people's like doing things like breaking up with their boyfriend or girlfriend in a text. You know, I haven't looked at research on it. I'll probably do it after we get off the air today. But I'm wondering about if there's a way in which technology, you know, may be sort of inadvertently deteriorating our ability to work things out face to face. I don't know, but if anecdotally, I hear about it a lot.
Absolutely, yes.
I hear about it. For me, this kind of process is a remedy for that. And it might give, especially young people, their first opportunity to see what it looks like to successfully work through a challenge with somebody instead of hiding behind their phone.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much more accountable.
Yeah.
So much more accountable than just, as you say, breaking up via text or trying to deal with things in a way that doesn't require any face-to-face. So, and let me just read real quick. We'll finish this out, and in our second half hour, we're going to talk about the conference that's coming up on Saturday that you can sign up for. But I also want to make a promise to the listeners, and I'll say it to Ruth and Kit. The next time I see any study, you know, if there's a study that finds this stuff doesn't work, we'll talk about it. But the evidence that keeps coming out, I always say I'm an evidence person, is in favor of this. And it's so that's what we're just trying to focus on. What does the evidence say? Well, number three from the Virginia study, improved relationships among people who've had conflict with each other. Here's a quote from a 10th grade male. Me and this other kid were about to fight, and I got in his face. I was upset, and, you know, everyone wanted to hype up the situation. It didn't end up like that. I wanted to get a little closer to see what he was saying, and so, well, me and him ended up being in a circle, and we were cool after that. That's a 10th grader saying we were this close to fighting, we got in a circle, we worked it out. Number four, less destructive conflict. When there is conflict, less destructive, less likely to lead to more extreme outcomes. Number five, meaningful dialogue for both students and adults. Another positive outcome of restorative circles was meaningful dialogue. Under this category, three specific types of benefits emerged: understanding and connecting, reducing rumors, and getting to the actual cause of a problem. And students and adults both said that. And number six on their list of benefits was academic and social achievements, which is probably obvious when you start thinking about more students staying in school, staying in class, going to class. But that was another benefit found. So the conclusions and the implications from that study found that those benefits reported by both students and adults were widespread and a direct result of restorative circles and restorative practices. Again, that's one study. It's the best I've seen in terms of an actual scientific kind of study, but it lines up with a lot of the other evidence that is coming out. But any study that Kit, we're coming back. If we find the next study says it doesn't work,
yeah,
we'll talk about it.
It's
I just haven't seen it.
You will never see it.
You don't believe that.
You will never see it. There is no way that being able to talk and connect with people will ever be negative. So I don't believe it exists at all. It is the most humane way of interacting with one another. It's a high level of respect deep empathy, deep understanding, really seeing people for who they are, not for who we think they are. So I'm a firm believer. I see it every single day. I see it in a community. I see it in the schools. I see it in the faith community. It is impossible for this to not work. It really is.
I want to say, if you have listeners that are interested in the student voice on this too, we did make last spring, we made a short film with voices from Monroe Middle School students who this study was with. And if I might, I can send you the link, and if maybe you would want to put it up.
We'll post it on the podcast page, and then Megan Mack and I will both post it on our Twitter feeds.
Yeah, because it's a very powerful local student voices, middle school, Monroe Middle School kids reflecting on this work. And it's just if people want to do something besides read that article.
I think my favorite part of what we saw in Virginia, what you see in Rochester, is the idea that students are doing this on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's not just perfunctory, look, okay, are you happy now? We did the circle. It's, we think it works and we're willing to do it. That's an amazing thing to see in young people.
Yep.
who are still forming their identities, handling conflict.
Absolutely, and as young as fourth grade, not just high school.
Fourth grade.
We've trained students fourth, fifth, sixth, and so on. So it's not just high school students who are learning to circle up and build community and learn to resolve conflict in a way that allows hearing each other's story. But like I said, as young as fourth graders.
Mm. All right. So listeners, if you want to weigh in on what you're hearing here, if you have any questions on restorative practices, how the circles work, what's going on in Rochester, your thoughts on that discipline and more, you can call the program toll free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Our guests are Ruth Turner, the Executive Director of Student Support Services for the Rochester City School District, and Kit Miller, Director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. They are here talking about an event that you can attend on this coming Saturday. It's the Restoring Rochester Conference. And we'll tell you when we come back more about the themes coming up and how you can get involved right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Steve Curwood joins us. He is the host of Living on Earth. Been hearing it on NPR member stations for the last 26 years. He's in Rochester today talking about climate change, climate justice, climate resilience, even green jobs in Rochester. He's our guest next hour, Steve Curwood of Living on Earth. Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here's a public apology that's been long, long overdue. In seventh grade, I broke up with Stacy Pettyjohn via text message, but there was no text messages then. So you know what I did? I was a coward. Right before ski club, when I wasn't going and Stacy was, I left a note in her locker, breaking up with her there. That was cowardly. I have felt bad about it to this day, but you know, she's doing just fine. She married a different Evan. She's working for the Rand Corporation, and she's writing interesting policy papers around the world. She doesn't need me. But Stacy, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I was not accountable. And, you know, I can joke about it and laugh about it now, but in a very serious way, I think Kit Miller raised such an interesting point. Especially kids, but adults too. We are communicating via text so often that we are not often having difficult conversations face-to-face and being accountable. And that's... Kit, what's the message when kids are growing up, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, all throughout high school, into their older years, and the lesson is you never have to have a hard conversation face-to-face? What do you think the possible result of that is in the future?
The collapse of our First Amendment rights. Because I just heard David K. Johnson here in town saying the only way to protect those things is to exercise them. So if we don't know how to talk to each other and gather together to talk about important things that affect our democracy, then we're not going to have one. Problems at work, because every single team needs to be able to be creative together, and creativity and conflict are actually two sides of the same coin. So, it has big implications. So I'm thinking about this fabulous young man who's he works now in Chicago Public Schools. He grew up here in Rochester. His mom's a friend. And he was visiting Rochester last year, and we were visiting, and I was asking him, quizzing him about the restorative work that he does in Chicago schools. And he's also very engaged with a lot of young activism in Chicago. And I said, I asked him, Jason, how do you account for all the activism among the young, among 20-somethings in Chicago? And he said, it's restorative practices, because we all learned how to talk to each other and work things out, and that our voices mattered in high school. So, I mean, I think that this work has significant implications for us as a community and, you know, as a country.
I think also is a lack of empathy. If we're not able to talk face to face and be able to feel the range of human emotions and realize that when you've disappointed somebody and hurt somebody, you're not going to be able to understand an empathy and express empathy.
Here, by the way, producer Megan Mack sends me this note, which dovetails beautifully with this. This is from The Atlantic, October 2015, The Flight from Conversation. Psychologist Sherry Turkle argues that replacing face-to-face communication with smartphones is diminishing people's capacity for empathy. And let me just read from what Turkle had to say. Quote, "The empathy that I'm talking about is a psychological capacity to put yourself in the place of another person and imagine what they are going through. It has neurological underpinnings. We know that we are wired to do it, because when you put young people in a summer camp when there are no devices, within 5 days, their capacity to watch a scene and then successfully identify what the people in the scene might be feeling begins to go back up again from being depressed when they first arrived armed with their devices. We suppress this capacity by putting ourselves in environments where we're not looking at each other in the eye, not sticking with the other person long enough or hard enough to follow what they're actually feeling."
Mm. Absolutely.
End quote. That's from producer Megan Mack. Great find.
Thanks, Megan.
Great stuff, and it is exactly the opposite of restorative circles, where they have to have that empathy develop face-to-face. So, and I think that's why the evidence shows that it's working. Well, on Saturday, from 8:30 to 2 at the Holiday Inn downtown, there's the Restoring Rochester Conference. Kit, who do you want in this community to attend? Who is this aimed at?
Everyone. I'm looking at Ruth.
Yep, yeah. Everyone. Educators, community members, faith community, any and everyone. It's a community event, exploring ways on how we as a community can move towards being more restorative in our policies and our practices and our behaviors.
Okay, so 8:30 to 2, you can still sign up, $15 per person. How do they sign up?
That's great. I gave you that information. They go to this really long...
really long, awful website, but we'll link to it for you. It's a piece of cake. I don't know if there's a phone number to call or anything to jump online, but we'll make sure the website gets
Yes, any questions, they can call out 262-8169, 262-8169.
It's also on the Gandhi Institute homepage, which is just gandhiinstitute.org.
Gandhiinstitute.org. You'll see the event there. And they have a couple of keynote speakers. I want to talk about first what Dr. Christina Watlinting is talking about, being trauma-informed and restorative. Trauma-informed. Ruth, I know trauma is a big issue in the city and in the school district right now.
Yep, I think it's big in our nation, not just isolated to the city, but we definitely feel the impact of that. So as I was sharing with you before we started the show, is that there is a large movement in the Rochester community to really become trauma-informed in our practices and responding to trauma. And I want to be very clear, because oftentimes people feel like, does that mean we're going to identify who's been traumatized, who hasn't? No, it's really just a universal strategy on how we deal with each other, understanding that people come with different stories, different experiences, even adults. You know, who knows what their personal experiences is like, and really understanding that people are either experiencing trauma directly or vicariously through other people, through their work, and responding in a way that in our practices that's helpful and helps promote self-care. So we really talk about how can we use restorative practices to become trauma and to practice trauma care. So we have circles around that. You know, it's the use of tone. It's the personal use of yourself as a professional, as an individual, and really realizing that even when we look at our students and we look at some of the childhood adverse experiences when we do our surveys, we see that a lot of our students experience trauma. I mean, before they're 18, they might have experienced 4 or 5 incidents of major trauma. I mean, growing up, I wasn't accustomed to having attended so many funerals as some of my students. They'll tell you some of them have been to 5 or 6 funerals before they graduate high school. That's major. And I'm not talking about the stranger next door. I'm talking about really close friends or family members. Then we have the issue of mass incarceration, you know. It's just on and on, just layers of trauma. And as I said, whether it's directly or witnessing it through the TV, witnessing through in your community, it's a major issue. So she's an expert around this, not only trauma-informed care, but culturally sensitive trauma-informed care. So we're talking about a community of color primarily in the city of Rochester. And what does that look like for a community of color? Okay, it may not be the same method that you might use elsewhere where you're dealing with individuals who may not be a community of color, but really working through a culturally sensitive lens when we talk about trauma and how do we respond to that. So she's going to be doing a keynote and a workshop around that. She'll be our lunch speaker for the conference on Saturday.
Okay. Kit, do you want to add there?
Well, I'm just thinking as you're speaking, Ruth, about Joy DeGruy's work and the work that she cites from, is it Benedict, Edwin Benedict? Anyways, it's someone who she cites looking at the axiology of different cultures.
Nicholson.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you. I knew I had it wrong. That people of European descent, like you and me, Evan, we are pretty object oriented. We're motivated by goals. We're motivated by objects. But the research of Dr. Nicholson is that actually people from other continents, especially the African
Native American,
South American, most people that are not from Europe are actually not object oriented. The axiology is relationship based. You're motivated by the relationships. So that's yet another reason, another research base for why this work matters.
That's a very good point. So oftentimes, you know, I will hear students say, and we look at it as a way of trying not to take personal accountability, but we'll hear students say, no, I don't like going into Miss So-and-so class. Why? Because she doesn't like me. He doesn't like me. What they're really saying is that I don't have a relationship. I don't know you. So the idea is relationship is paramount. It's important. So before we can get into the business of teaching and learning, we have to build a relationship. Our students have to know, and it has to be genuine, that you understand them and that there's a deep love and respect, essentially. And that's Dr. Joy's work is around how do we convey that love and respect to our students so that we can get love and respect back. So it's this whole concept of relationship model. So the theme, even with restorative practice, trauma-informed care, Dr. Joyce DeGruy is relationship, relationship, relationship. The deeper, the more meaningful the relationship, the better results we will get, irregardless of the trauma, irregardless of our background.
Okay. A couple other quick comments before we talk about the second theme of one of their keynotes. First of all, Justin Murphy is a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, and he's listening to the conversation today. And he says on Twitter, really glad to hear this conversation with Ruth Turner et al. On restorative practices. I've got a big package on Rochester City School District restorative practices coming soon. So, and Justin always does great work for the DNC. So thank you, Justin. We certainly look forward to seeing his reporting on that. Here's an email, though, from MJ pushing back a little, or I think opens the door to talk about a very specific issue and whether it can be addressed with restorative practices. She writes the following, quote, there was a recent thread on social media about a local semi-rural school that uses restorative justice. People felt that while it may help direct conflict that could otherwise lead to suspension, it did nothing to help the increasing problem of bullying, which is a far more and different problem than fighting, etc., far more subtle and more pervasive. That's from MJ.
I can respond to
that.
Yeah,
please.
So this is where we talk about the proactive circles. Because restorative practice does, in fact, improve relationships. And we know that bullying occurs because there's a lack of relationship or there's a negative relationship. So those proactive circles in which you're teaching school community to be a community, to truly have relationship with one another. So we know that even when you think about people who bully you, it's often the person who doesn't know you, somebody who you don't have a very good relationship with. Typically, your friend does not bully you. So again, it's being skillful to understand that it's a mindset. It's not a program. So we really have to internalize it and begin to model it for our students. But I can't tell you countless circles we do around bullying. Countless. Majority of the time is those kind of circles.
And you've seen results.
Oh, yeah. We've seen results. We've seen results like people when they're in circle and begin to share. You know, like, you know, what upset me was that you were making fun of my mother, but you don't know me. You don't understand that my mother died 2 years ago, or my mother is drug addicted, or my mother is ill. And then students begin, you see the walls breaking down and you see the empathy. Oh, I didn't know that. So it's what kind of environment are we creating so that students feel safe to trust the circle? So whenever we think it's not working, we have to look back as to what are we, the practitioners, failing to do, in a sense, what environment have we not created so that everybody feels safe in a circle? So when the circle doesn't work, it's because there's no trust in the circle.
I'm glad, you know, I Thank you, MJ, for the email. I mean, my thought is that probably they're mostly using restorative for discipline. I bet, because if they were using it in the community building way that Ruth has referenced several times today, then I think things would have begun to shift. But if they're only using it as a new way to be like look less punitive, the trust isn't going up and the relationships aren't changing, and that's why more subtle things like bullying, which the teachers would be getting information about if there was a different kind of relationship building going on. And I don't mean to criticize, but that's just my guess, not knowing more.
Okay, and let me just ask sort of a functional question, a question on how the functionality of a circle. Let's say there is a bullying situation. How big would the circle be? Who would be involved? Would all parties have to agree to sit down? Do you tell students you must be a part of it?
Nope.
So Ruth, tell me how this works.
So again, there is not a perfect formula. It's very customized.
Okay.
So when we think about coming in and helping to do these kind of circles, is number one is voluntary. You can't make people come to the circle and force them to participate.
I know our listeners are hearing this going, well, then bullies are not going to sit down and be like, my hands in the air.
You'd be very surprised how they're invited. The invitation is very important.
Okay.
So again, this is where I take, well, we have to be skillful. So number one, it is voluntary. I have not had yet one student say, no, I don't want to participate. Yet. So, and I deal with a lot of students who don't know me. So I'm coming in. I'm not even in the community. Technically, I'm from downtown. So that's number one. Number two, so what you got to say is, okay, there's a problem. We want to talk about it. We want to hear your point of view. And your point of view is no judgment. There's no right or wrong. Okay, and students come to the circle most of the time, and they figure it out. Now, does it take time, especially when we're talking about a wrongdoing circle? Yeah, it takes time, and you have to prep people. You don't just come in and say, you know, I'm calling Evan out of the classroom and Kit, and we're going to do this. There has to be preparation that takes place. But if a community is already accustomed to restorative practice, and this is the way we do business in this community, then that's just how they do it. There's a problem to circle up. You'll hear that language in communities where
circle up.
Yeah, where they're familiar. There's an issue. You know, the students will sometimes say, we'll do it, or they'll ask for a circle, because it's already 80% of the time has been built on building those communities. So then when there's a wrongdoing, there's an environment already created to be able to address the wrongdoing. But as kids said, we think that this is a fix for those suspension issues, for the wrongdoing. We can't jump to wrongdoing until we've built the community. A community of trust and respect. It's just not going to happen. It's just, you're just getting in a circle and lecturing and talking as you've always done before.
Okay. All right, let me grab another phone call, and then we're going to talk about their second keynote. But this is Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling just to say I really totally support this approach. It has all kinds of values. I am a social worker, and, you know, when you talk about relationships, that's a key piece to that discipline, and frankly should be more accepted from and every situation, including this obsession with some technologies, as somebody mentioned earlier. Also, I was glad to hear that the issue, even though you didn't use the R word, the racism word, as far as trauma, I was very glad to hear that was mentioned in this discussion. I also have to say, however, the sad part of all this is that there are many of us and many others who are more progressive on these issues, and have been trying for years and years and years and years and years to get not just the school district, but to get society in general more in tune with this. You know, we talked about the criminal justice system as a perfect example of the opposite of what should be done. And when we are able to do it, then we can move forward. But it's been such a missed opportunity for so many years that it has a kind of a happy, sad note to it. And hope we can, you know, kind of continue to sustain that approach and generalize it to other things, because I think a lot of oppressions in this country fit into this discussion as well. So thank you.
All right, Bonnie, thank you. Thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very grateful for the support and interest from RIT's Department of Criminal Justice and John Clovis's Center for Public Safety in restorative. Very big supporters, and I hope we're really creating a new generation of people involved with criminal justice and who are looking seriously at this. You know, you mentioned Dominic Barter, and a lot of his work is in criminal justice settings in Brazil. He told me something years ago. He said, you know, a lot of the shift to restorative, especially in youth courts and youth prisons in Brazil, which was in where they were in desperate circumstances, was because of their desperation. He says people often become more willing to innovate when they're a bit desperate. So I'd say to Bonnie, hold on. Maybe we're just getting desperate enough to start doing some of the right things here.
And speaking of criminal justice, oh, go ahead, Ruth. I know you want to jump in.
No, I wanted to say, I also want to acknowledge the work that's taking place primarily in family court. There is a move. Judges are working together to understand that when they look at the students and families before them, there was a study done, and it 90% have experienced some level of major trauma in their childhood. Mm-hmm. So understanding this link between trauma and harm being done and the need to heal and not just be completely punitive. So there is, I just want to acknowledge that work that's taking place in the court systems around this.
I just got a phone call from a local Supreme Court judge asking me about restorative options for a case. So it's definitely happening.
And here's an email from a different Ruth who writes, listen to this story. She says, when I was in my 20s, I was working on an organic farm in New Zealand when someone broke into my car and stole a bunch of stuff. When they caught him, he turned out to be a teenager, which is when I learned that the juvenile justice system in New Zealand is based on the traditional Maori justice system. It sounds very similar, and are your panelists familiar with it? I found it very refreshing and effective, and wonder if they think there's any chance the U.S. might ever incorporate these ideas into the state and federal system.
We're hoping.
Colorado already has their one state. I think that there's at least one other state, too, that's actually incorporated restorative as the formal youth adjudication. I mean, it's kind of the point of entry into criminal justice is through youth, because people are going to be a little less likely to, you know, go to that knee-jerk, tough-on-crime kind of perspective.
And that's the movement that we're taking place even in Rochester. I mean, it's slow moving, but there's definitely an interest in understanding that needs to happen.
I think Minnesota is another state. I also think like Sweden. I'm aware of there's a handful of states and a handful of countries that have been doing this for a long time. So even if we engaged in it as a state, we would be following some well-trodden path.
Okay, and well, before I lose the hour, I should mention that the other keynote is going to come on Saturday from Dr. Abdul Malik Muhammad, and the name of that keynote is Empowering Our Boys of Color, Restorative Practices as a Key Element. Why that theme, Ruth?
Because we need it. I mean, you know, when we talk about data, when we look at suspension data, when we look at disproportionality in terms of special education classification, when we look around our criminal justice system, there definitely seems to be a theme that there is this need to really begin to empower a young man of color. In all honesty, I think systemically we need to do things differently. The caller mentioned about there's experience of racism, discrimination, perhaps how they're policed. So looking at that, and again, I mentioned this is partly funded through my Brother's Keeper Initiative, which emphasizes and focuses around young men of color. We really felt like that was something in this community as educators and community members we really need to understand and have a better understanding in terms of how do we begin to share power and empower our young men. There's going to be a wonderful student panel of all young men of color panel. We're going to have a school panel. There's going to be a lot of wonderful things taking place on Saturday. There's a section where we talk about from incarceration to restoration, where we're going to hear a story of a gentleman who went through the criminal justice system and his restorative story behind that. There's workshops for the faith-based community, spirituality and restorative practice, nonviolent communication. There's so much wonderful things happening on Saturday. We hope that you will come out because there's still space available for people to register and join us.
$15 and lunch. I mean, how can you do that?
And breakfast.
And breakfast.
Breakfast, lunch, $15, and the number to call.
For information, is 262-8169. But if you want to register, I believe you will have that.
Yeah, we'll have the website. We'll post on our podcast, our Twitter feeds. Against my better judgment, I'm going to take Joel's phone call, but it's got to be tight. Go ahead, Joel.
Just really quickly, the great work that Kit and Ruth and the other folks do needs to be supported, vigilantly supported. And I would encourage a lot of people in Rochester that have money and the foundations that are here in Rochester support the work that should be done in every single school in the district and countywide.
Joel, thank you.
Thank you.
A vote of support there. And I'm hearing from a number of people. In fact, I've got some texts that I can't read on the air, but just essentially saying these women should run this country. So I don't know about if you want those jobs.
We'll take it.
You take it?
Right now, I think it would be good to replace somebody.
I don't have that authority, Kit Miller. But we will make sure if you want to check out what's going on Saturday with the Restoring Rochester Conference. Kit, final word from you, because you do workshops. You've been working on restorative issues for a number of years now. How do you view where this community is versus where it's been and where you think it's going in this issue?
I think the attention, both to restorative and also to really taking seriously the need to deal with racism together, are truly powerful and hopeful things happening here in Rochester. And it's a way we can take control of our community regardless of what's happening at a national level.
Ruth, you agree?
I absolutely agree. I often agree with whatever Kit Miller says.
That's why we hang out.
I do wholeheartedly agree, and I think we're moving ahead. It's great to see just so many like-minded people coming and supporting the work.
Thank you, Evan.
Ruth
Thank
Turner
you.
From the Rochester State School District, Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, and you can see them this Saturday at the Holiday Inn downtown, 8:30 to 2 for the Restoring Rochester Conference. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Short break and more connections is next.